You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. The Lost Years, Radical Islam, Intifada, and Wars in the Middle East, 2001 to 2006, is Charles Enderlin's detailed account of the events of five turbulent years in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, a period that includes the death of Yasser Arafat, the replacement of Ariel Sharon, Israel's withdrawal from settlements in Gaza, Hamas coming to power, and Israel's war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Charles Enderlin has been the Jerusalem bureau chief of the French public television network France 2 since 1990. The Lost Years is published by Other Press, and I'm pleased it brings Charles Enderlin back to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
This book picks up where your last book, Shattered Dreams, left off, with the failure of the peace agreement at Camp David in the summer of 2000. Now, Arafat was blamed for rejecting the agreement, but you say that Ehud Barak was as much to blame. What caused the failure?
First of all, at the end of Camp David, President Bill Clinton put the blame on Arafat. I believe it was wrong. Anyway, negotiations restarted immediately in Jerusalem and Ramallah between Israelis and Palestinians and went on until the beginning of the Intifada at the end of September. Mm-hmm. Camp David failed because one problem, Jerusalem. The Israelis, with the support of the Americans, were ready only to offer to Arafat limited municipal autonomy in East Jerusalem. Bill Clinton corrected that later on when, on the 23rd of December 2000, he presented his parameters for peace to both parties, to the Israelis and the Palestinians. And there he picked again, for the first time, the Palestinian proposal for East Jerusalem, that is, a borough with a Jewish majority should come under Israeli sovereignty, a borough with an Arab majority should come under Palestinian sovereignty. So at the time when he gave his parameters to the parties, both sides told him, listen, it's a pity we didn't start with that because we would have had already an agreement. Mm. 2 weeks later, Bill Clinton left the White House, George Bush came to power in Israel, Ariel Sharon came to power, and we had a totally different history.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you said something at the beginning of your answer that I would ask you to. You said you think Bill Clinton was wrong to blame Arafat. Why?
First of all, because it was not the end of the peace process. Mm-hmm. It was a stage in the peace process. Negotiations continued immediately. Mm-hmm. In Camp David, there was progress on several files. But one of the problems also was mismanagement of the peace process by the American administration, by the Clinton administration. For example, you will be surprised to hear that from all those negotiations, almost 3 weeks in Camp David, there is not one agreed upon protocol from the different commissions on the different very important subjects that were treated, refugees, borders, peace. This was a major impediment for the continuation of the talks between Israelis and Palestinians. They had to restart again on many files for which were already discussed in Camp David.
Mm-hmm. Now, in early 2001, Ariel Sharon was, as you mentioned before, he was elected Prime Minister of Israel, defeating Ehud Barak. Why did Barak lose that election, you think?
For internal reasons. He was called the zigzag Prime Minister, taking one decision, canceling it, going back, forth. On the Palestinian file, he at first stopped any negotiation because of the intifadas and renewed them, then announced there won't be an agreement and said there might be an agreement. The Israeli public were completely fed up with it, and Ariel Sharon had a very effective electoral campaign promising to the Israeli peace with security.
Mm-hmm. Now, would that have been a continuation of Barak's peacemaking efforts or completely different?
Completely different. Ariel Sharon's goal was, first of all, to crush the Palestinian uprising. The first suicide bombing, the first major terrorist attacks happened much later, happened already in April, May 2001. But until then, we had a lot of fighting on the ground between Israeli military, between the Israeli army and Palestinian militants, and you had also many Palestinian youngsters clashing with the Israeli army, stone throwing, Molotov cocktails, mm-hmm. and Israeli retaliation. You know, after a month and a half of clashes at the beginning of November 2000, the General Amos Malka, the Israeli head of military intelligence, asked some of his officers to check how many bullets the Israeli army used during the first month of repression of the Intifada. And he was quite surprised by the answer, 1 million bullets. And the analysis stemming from that was that the Israeli army is changing the reality on the ground. During the first months of the Intifada, 60 Palestinians were killed, 6 Israelis. This was a ratio that the Palestinian militants couldn't accept and which made only things even worse.
Mm. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Charles Enderlin about his new book, The Lost Years. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Mr. Enderlin, once Ariel Sharon was elected, as you just said, there were lots of suicide bombings and Molotov cocktails, and the young were agitated by this. Were they egged on by Yasser Arafat? How did he greet Sharon's election?
First of all, he believed that one way or another, the Intifada will prevail. Mm-hmm. But there we had a very interesting discussion, because in parallel of this conflict, you have constantly what I can call a media campaign. And almost from the beginning, the Israeli officials were saying that Arafat started the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, and was directing it. And to get the truth, as a reporter, this was not my feeling from the ground. Mm-hmm. My feeling was that it was quite a spontaneous agitation, a spontaneous uprising. But in 2006, at last, in front of my camera and for quote, I got who was head of Shin Bet, the Israeli Internal Security Administration, who said, contrary to what we announced and accused at the time, Arafat did not foment, did not generate, did not organize the Intifada. This was a spontaneous movement. And Arafat, at the beginning, probably didn't do enough to calm down the situation. He probably didn't want, maybe was afraid to clash with the militants. And later on, when it was for him very urgent to bring calm in the territories, in the Palestinian territories, to try to get to an agreement, he didn't have any more the power to do it.
I was going
to
ask you, how much power did Yasser Arafat have to control the Palestinian people? Not a whole lot, it seems.
The Fatah and even his police and security and the Palestinian security, they are not the American army, the Marine Corps. You have clans, you have groups, and two or three Palestinian organizations did not participate in the Intifada, but others simply started also fighting the Israelis.
So was Yasser Arafat leader in name only?
He was a weak leader. He was, sadly, and this is part of the Palestinian tragedy, he stayed the leader of a liberation movement. He never became the statement that the Palestinian needed at this time in history. For example, he did not build the institutions of the future state. And he was, at the end, a weak leader. And this is sadly what brought us to this situation today. He did not understand the Israelis, and especially he did not understand that the world changed after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great segue into my next question, which, what was the effect of 9/11 on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
For the Israelis, it was a moment to prove, especially to the American public, that the Palestinians are like Bin Laden, which is not true. You have the majority of the Palestinian population is quite moderate and willing to live in peace. And probably if you give them visas, most of them will come to live happily in the United States. So that evening, that afternoon, the Israeli officials and some even officers did their best to try to get pictures of some Palestinians rejoicing. There were a few demonstrations of a few people in East Jerusalem. There were maybe a few more in Naples, and for them to show this video to the to the world, and especially to the United, to the American public, this was the right moment. Arafat was first under shock, and all the Palestinian leadership was at first praying that there were no Palestinians in the 9/11 terror, with the 9/11 terrorists, which was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Up to now, you didn't have one Palestinian coming from the West Bank or from Gaza within Al-Qaeda, up to now. Arafat didn't know what to do. How can I show my support to the Americans? And then somebody came with the idea, you know what, you are going to donate blood. But Arafat said, what, a needle in my arm at my age? I told him, hey, listen, he's even healthy, give some blood. No, I don't want. So what they did, they staged the blood donation of Arafat. The doctor was showing a pack of blood, and he had a needle on his arm, not entering the vein. That was the story. But you know, it's a gesture. And the video that was, Arafat donates blood for American victims. For the Israeli, it was a moment to show that they support the United States. The Palestinians tried to do it. But the problem that we had was Hamas doing more and more suicide bombings. And in the mind of everybody, a Palestinian is a suicide bomber, as 9/11 terrorists. And this was parallel to the media war.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the rest of the world view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict after 9/11?
There was a decision by Europe, and I believe the United States, with Colin Powell quite engaging the region, trying to go fast for an agreement. But already we had a catch-22 situation. Hamas understood very fast that by committing suicide bombings, they could prevent any advance in the Middle East peace process. And in parallel, the Israelis, with the Israeli army, with the decision of Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, reacted at each major terrorist attack against the authority, even when it was done by Hamas. So Hamas very fast found itself in a win-win position.
Hmm.
Not only that they kill any possibility of an agreement, of even a possible ceasefire with suicide bombing,
mm-hmm.
but also the Israelis attack as retaliation their political enemy, that is the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat and the Fatah.
We're going to take a break, and I want to talk to you more about Hamas. I'm speaking with Charles Enderlin about the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. He wrote The Lost Years for Other Press. We'll be right back. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and our guest right now is Charles Enderlin, whose new book, The Lost Years, Radical Islam, Intifada, and Wars in the Middle East, 2001 to 2006, is just out and published by Other Press. Mr. Enderlin, again, welcome. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So you were talking about Hamas before we went to the break, and in 2003, Israel killed Ahmed Yassin, who's the founder of Hamas. You write that the CIA noticed a worldwide reaction. What did they see?
It was Mike Scheuer who was in charge, one of the CIA agent in charge of following what's happening with Al-Qaeda. And he told me that you had areas in the Muslim world where before that you had almost no demonstration in favor of the Palestinians, that the public usually barely knew where Israel or where the Palestinian territories were. And after the killing of Yassin, suddenly demonstration in some Muslim areas of the Philippines, some areas in Pakistan, areas which were not concerned before with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, suddenly woke up to it. And with the consequence that, of course, the American, the United States were blamed for it.
Hmm. Now, let's go to 2000. March 2003. That was just before the Iraq War started, and President Bush announced his acceptance of the roadmap for peace. What made this a roadmap?
This was an initiative of the quartet with European, UN, Russian, and American representatives. The situation on the ground in the Palestinian territory was quite dire. We had still the suicide bombing in Israel, many Palestinian casualties, casualties in Israel also less. You know, the ratio today is you have 3,500 Palestinians killed since the beginning of the Intifada, 1,200, 1,300 Israelis. That's quite a bloody conflict. And the international community, the quartet, decided something, some sort of diplomatic initiative must be on the table, and they put forward this roadmap. It starts with things, with elements that just were not and cannot be implemented anywhere, not at that stage. The Palestinians fighting terrorism. The Palestinian in 2003 didn't have any more security services, police. The West Bank was... all the roads in the West Bank were cut by Israeli checkpoint. And anyway, I interviewed several Israeli brigadiers, military officers, who said, what are you talking about, fighting against Palestinian terrorists? We even do not allow the guard, the Palestinian guard of a Palestinian court, to carry a handgun. So they didn't have not the guns, not the power. This was one element of the roadmap. The second element, the Israelis were supposed, if the Palestinians fight terrorism, to start evacuating settlements, and especially the settlements that were not approved by the Israeli government and were built after 2000, 2001. So the roadmap was from the very beginning a non-starter, and it still is. I asked one of the major negotiators of the roadmap, who is today the Spanish Foreign Minister, Miguel Moratinos. He was at the time the representative of the quartet in the area, of the Europeans. He told me, what do you want? We diplomats, we always need something to go on. We know perfectly nothing will happen, but at least we have something to talk about. This leaves some sort of hope, at least to the diplomats. But basically, the roadmap was a non-starter.
Now, the roadmap also called for the appointment of a Palestinian prime minister. Now, why was this important to the United States?
It was to prevent from Arafat to continue controlling the Palestinian government. This was a basic American idea, and this was following President Bush's vision of peace. You know, when he prepared his famous speech about his vision of peace, the idea was, will he or not ask for a new Palestinian leadership? Mm-hmm. Understand? Without Arafat, or Arafat neutralized. And the Chinese office requested from the Israeli intelligence elements to present to the president, to Bush, the proof that Arafat was a terrorist. They had meetings and meetings in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. And Dan Meridor, an Israeli who was minister with his portfolio in charge of Israeli intelligence, asked, okay, give me the facts. They didn't have. All they could bring was a conversation recorded between a non-important Fatah operative and another militant. The guy was saying, the old man gave me $20,000 to commit an attack. $20,000, everybody said, this is not real, and who is this guy, and this is absolutely no proof. You know, I asked military intelligence officials, listen, how did you know what was going on in the Mukata, Arafat said, quote, and they told me it's completely transparent for us. We know everything is there. I said, listen, I don't believe you. Imagine that Arafat in the toilet writes on a piece of paper to somebody, do this, do that, and then secretly gives it to somebody. And you will be surprised to hear that the answer was from this Israeli officer, this also, we would have known it. Everything that was going on the Palestinian side, with the Palestinian leaders, the Israeli intelligence knew it.
In the end, Mahmoud Abbas was chosen as prime minister. But he ended up resigning 6 months later. Why?
Two reasons. The first one is Palestinian. Arafat, jealous, was constantly acting against him. even sometimes sending militants to threaten him. And two, he didn't have anything to present to his public opinion. He wanted from the Israeli liberation, freeing Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. He wanted the lifting of checkpoints to show that he, as a prime minister, achieves things for the general Palestinian population. Didn't happen. So on one side, pressure from Arafat, Arafat office, threats. On the other, nothing to show. He resigned.
And then what? He resigned, and then who came in?
Then very fast. No, we had Abu Ala, another Palestinian, replacing him, not doing anything. We were in a total stalemate until Arafat died, and Abbas was elected as chairman of the Palestinian Authority.
So the Geneva Initiative, which was in 2003, the United States wasn't involved in that, was
it? No, this is an initiative of moderates from both sides. You have ex-Palestinian who spent quite a few years in Israeli jail, condemned for terrorism, Palestinian Fatah leaders. You had on the Israeli side not only leftist, but you had ex-chief of staff, people who were before that in the Israeli army, officers from the Israeli police, professors, members of Knesset. And it was quite an interesting development, and it was a proof, I believe, for everybody, but also for the Israeli public who maybe didn't understand it, that on the Palestinian side, you have a peace camp. The Palestinians, moderates, who signed the Geneva Initiative with the Palestinians, the Israelis who signed it, they are a Palestinian peace camp.
But Sharon called it, quote, the most dangerous historic error made since Oslo. Why did he reject it?
Because he was against it. Because he refused it, absolutely. The Geneva Initiative meant major Israeli territorial concessions, including in Jerusalem, which Ariel Sharon refused. Ariel Sharon, in April 2001, gave a famous interview to an Israeli newspaper saying he's willing to give a little more than 40% of the West Bank to the Palestinians, if not more. The rest, 50 and something, would be used for Israeli security areas. And he was absolutely not ready to make any concession in East Jerusalem. So if you have Israeli moderates proposing to the Palestinians major territorial concessions, Sharon was against it.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart here for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Charles Enderlin about his new book, The Lost Years. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. As we said, as we started, I asked you about the Geneva Initiative, and we talked about why the United States was against it. But how did Colin Powell react to it, who was then at the time Secretary of State?
Against... this initiative didn't have the support of what we call the neocon group within the American administration, and who constantly acted against the policy and the initiatives of Colin Powell. And what he did is to invite in Washington, in his office, the two leaders, Yossi Beilin, the Israeli, and Yasser Abed Rabo, the Palestinian, who prepared this Geneva Initiative. He invited them at the State Department. Elliot Abrams and others didn't like that so much, and I believe Mr. Cheney didn't like it either.
But Sharon did start removing settlements from Gaza in 2004. So made him change his mind?
It happened in 2005. This was at a moment where there were tremendous international pressure on the Israelis to get on or with Syria, or with the Palestinians. There were direct proposal for negotiations from the Syrian leadership, from President Bashar Assad. The Israeli leadership with Ariel Sharon wanted to find a way to kill all this process. So the basic idea was, let's evacuate the settlements from Gaza. They are a security burden. They are constantly attacked by Palestinian militants. They are a small minority, 7,000-8,000 settlers among a sea of 1,400,000 Palestinians, the most crowded place almost on earth, I believe even more to, demographically, statistically, more crowded than Hong Kong per square mile. And they did the evacuation from the settlements without any agreement with the Palestinians. And I quote in my book a lawyer by the name of Weissglass, who was the main advisor to Ariel Sharon at the time, and he says that the withdrawal from Gaza is meant to kill the peace process. It was done without any negotiation with the Palestinians, and the outcome, we had it later, was Hamas controlling, taking control of Gaza. The whole world approved, of course, the withdrawal from Gaza, and didn't understand the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sharon had a massive cerebral hemorrhage and fell into a coma in 2006, and he's still in a coma today and not expected to recover. So what happened in Israel when Sharon was suddenly out of the picture?
Shock, sadness. He was a leader that the Israelis loved. He was with Shimon Peres, one of the last from the time of the founding fathers. He fought in the 48 war. He is somebody who was a constant figure in the Israeli politics, but life goes on, politics goes on. Ehud Olmert replaced him, and I believe had quite fast, at first, support of the Israeli public.
I was about to ask you, what's the popular opinion of Ehud Olmert in Israel?
Today, very low, because the failures of the war in Lebanon in 2006... the three divisions, 30,000 Israeli soldiers couldn't not overcome a few thousand of Hezbollah militants, activists.
They were surprised by the weapons that Hezbollah had.
They were surprised by everything. This was a failure of intelligence. This was a failure of tactical skill of the Israeli army on the ground. Do you have any idea how many prisoners all the thousands of Israeli soldiers took in South Lebanon? Two. They came back from South Lebanon with two Hezbollah prisoners. Strange, no?
Mm-hmm. And so this was such a failure that there was a commission, the Winograd, and I'm pronouncing this incorrectly.
Yeah, absolutely. The report comes out on the 30th this month. It seems that it will be quite critical of Ehud Olmert, and we might enter a government crisis in Israel in the coming few weeks or months.
What government crisis?
Some partners in his parliamentary coalition might simply leave him, and he will lose a majority of the parliament.
Is his coalition shaky to begin with?
It's starting to be very shaky. Up to now, it was not. But, you know, if I may, we have in the area two weak leaders. Abbas, who cannot and will not have his security forces, his weak security forces, fight for the security of Israel. You have Ehud Olmert, who will not and cannot, for political and military reasons, lift checkpoints in the West Bank or evacuate settlements. The only thing those two leaders can do, maybe with a third weak leader at the end of his term, George W. Bush, negotiate an agreement, bring in the paper. We know, the Israeli know, the Palestinians know what it takes. They know the red lines of each other. The Palestinians know what the Israeli can and cannot accept, and the contrary. We need a few weeks to negotiate. We have the files from Camp David. We have the files from Taba. We have the Geneva Initiative. We have the Mitchell Report. They will...
What about Annapolis?
Annapolis is with an embedded flaw. Giving 1 year to negotiate such an agreement that can be negotiated in a few weeks or a few months is giving 1 year to all the extremists to kill the negotiating process. They did it in the past. At every important crossroad of history in the Middle East since 1994, Hamas and other extremists killed it.
So at the end of President Clinton's term, He was emphatic. I remember being at a dinner at the Waldorf in January 2001. He said, paraphrasing here, "I'm going to work until my very last minute in office to get an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians." We've recently seen President Bush say, as you just mentioned, you know, by the end of my term, I want an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It seems like every president has been shooting for that. And never get there. It doesn't sound like you hold out much hope that President Bush will be successful.
They want to do it. They bring the negotiating team, Abbas, Olmert, in New York or anywhere else, and they do it. We are a long time after 2001. Situation has changed in the ground. The window of opportunity for peace is closing because the situation is getting harder and harder, and because also of Hamas. So they have the possibility to negotiate, bring in the paper, forget situation on the ground, do it, go after an agreement for referendum, democratic approval of an agreement in Israel and the Palestinian territories, and you will have an agreement. But if you play or try to change reality on the ground, you won't do it.
So the Israeli leader is weak. The Palestinian leader is weak. The current American leader is weak. Will the next American president, whether Democrat or Republican, be on stronger ground, firmer foundation to negotiate a new peace process or to negotiate peace, period?
Israel and the Middle East crisis is also an internal American affair. You have lobbies working for it. You have the support, very strong support for Israel. Remember how George Bush, the father, was criticized for having brought the Israeli leaders biting and kicking to the Madrid conference in 1991. If the next president, whoever he or she will be, wants to make an agreement, don't wait for the second term, because you might not have any possibility to do it. Do it in the first 3 months. If not, the Middle East in turmoil will bring you only more and more problems. Do it during the first 3 months. Afterwards, you will have all the internal pressure and also pressure from the outside not to do it.
I've been speaking with Charles Enderlin. His new book is The Lost Years, just out from Other Press. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.